You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
That night, Mr. Heilprin and I happened to visit a cafe where we used to go on days devoid of pleasure. Mr. Heilprin is highborn of an ancient family, one of those distinguished families of Israel that have sustained us during our long exile and given us power to stand among the nations. Sometimes, be he in high spirits or low, when surrounded by willing listeners, he recounts the glory of his ancestors. Having studied secular sciences rather than the Torah, he does not boast of his ancestors' learning. Instead, he describes their homes and business dealings. And even from these everyday matters, one hears how gracious were those early generations and how gracious their deeds. And one's soul weeps in secret for the pride of Israel, wrested from them, and not to return till the coming of the Messiah. This is G.P. Gottlieb, host for New Books and Literature at the New Books Network. And today I'm talking to Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs, series editor of the S.Y. Agnon Library at the Toby Press. A teacher, editor, and author of books on Jewish thought, education, and literature, Rabbi Sachs directs the online webyeshiva.org program and was recently appointed as editor of Tradition, the premier journal of Orthodox Jewish thought published in English. Rabbi Sachs lives in Efrat, Israel, with his wife, Ilana, and their four children. Hello, Rabbi Sachs. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Galit. It's nice to be with you.
So let's start with a question that I'm curious about. When did you start being interested in Shai Agnon?
Oh, well, like an Agnon story itself. My interest in Agnon is rather long and complicated, and it never actually comes out the same way twice. But the short answer is that growing up as a Jewish teenager in the United States, in a home that was not terribly connected to Jewish learning, aside from some basic Jewish traditions, I had become more interested in Jewish life and learning and observance in high school. And around that time, one of my grandmothers bought for me a copy of what was then called 21 Stories. It was a rather odd collection of anthologized short stories that had been translated over the years, Agnon stories, translated over the years. And she bought it for me because I suppose she knew that I'd become more interested in Jewish life. And here was this great Israeli author who had won the Nobel Prize, and she was the type of woman that would have taken note of such a thing. And I read it then in translation. I could not have read him in Hebrew at that point. Even if I could have read him in Hebrew, all of his very many rich allusions and intertextual connections to the wealth of biblical and rabbinic literature would have been completely lost on me. But nevertheless, I understood, as did those as did those judges in Stockholm that gave him the Nobel, I understood that he was saying something very profound about the condition of contemporary religious life, contemporary Jewish life, about the transition from the old world to the new. And these were things that were very much occupying me. So I became very interested in him. I was, you know, quite a bookish kid at that point in my life. And I continued to read him. And years later, when I came to live in Israel, I endeavored to read him in the original Hebrew. But unfortunately, my Hebrew was not quite good enough. I was defeated by it. And I continued to read in translation, the few translations that were available. And then at one point, I've now been living in Israel for 25 years. At one point, I guess my Hebrew had passed the tipping point, and I began to re-encounter him more seriously in the original. And quite on a whim, I had this idea that having read a fair amount of Agnon's writing, I could read the whole thing. I could read the whole collected works in 24 volumes, in 23 volumes, beginning to end. And like all of those kinds of immersion projects, you learn a tremendous amount about the thing you're immersing yourself into, and then it kind of serves as a lens back onto yourself to, you know, understand something about your own self and your own situation. I undertook this project, and then I became involved in the work of the Agnon House, which is a wonderful institution. Your listeners should visit the next time they're in Jerusalem, which was the home that he lived in from 1931 until his death in 1970, where he wrote in the majority of his great works, where his library and study are still preserved. And at that research and teaching center, I began delivering courses. And of course, the best way to understand anything, to master anything, is to start teaching it. So I began doing that quite a number of years ago. And then I fell into this work at the Toby Press that we are here to talk about today, of translating and editing the work of other translators and annotating his material for an English reading audience.
Ah, so how did the Toby Press come to underwrite this whole project, and how did you connect with them to be its series editor?
The Toby Press is an important publisher of Hebrew literature in translation. It's now part of a larger conglomerate of Jewish publishing under the flagship of the Koren Publishers, which are doing very important work here in Jerusalem in translating the Talmud and producing a whole variety of new prayer books and Bibles in Hebrew and English and other languages. But the Toby Press line dedicates itself to things in, let's say, larger issues of Jewish literature and writing. And the publisher, Matthew Miller, had kind of set it as a kind of goal, as an attempt to stock the shelves with fine translation and to advance a certain cause of reviving interest in Hebrew literature amongst worldwide readers. And Agnon, of course, is the crown and the jewel of anybody interested in translating Hebrew literature for a worldwide audience. And it began with one volume, and then I became involved. And like most of these projects, it grew. I think initially we talked about doing 5 volumes, and then it grew to 7 volumes, and ultimately we did 15 volumes in translation. And thankfully, there's been quite a very positive response to the project and to the series. There have been some very nice reviews written in some of the important platforms of literary criticism about the work that we've done.
So let's talk about Agnon. He started writing at 14 in Yiddish in Poland. Can you talk about him a little bit and then what happened to his writing?
Yeah, so Agnon is born in a little town. It's not technically, or at least I say, it's not technically a shtetl. When people hear shtetl, they think Fiddler on the Roof. But Agnon is born into the world of the Austro-Hungarian Empire in a region called Galicia, which where he lived is today in Western Ukraine, but then it was the eastern reaches of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. He's born in 1888, at least that's what he said. In fact, he was born in 1887. It was part of the mythologizing of his own biography, his date of birth and his name and other biographical facts. But he's born in 1887, in the summer of 87, in this little town called Buchach, in Galicia. When he's growing up there at the end of the 19th century, it's a town of 10 or 12,000 people, about 60% of whom are Jews. He's born into a completely traditional, what we would today call an ultra-Orthodox family, but it's not the world of Russian Jewry or Polish Jewry. It's a world where he's exposed to things that might not have been on the regular yeshiva curriculum. He studies in the cheder, the traditional one-room schoolhouse, but his father, who was himself a rabbi and a scholar, but earned his living in the fur trade, his father had something of the poet in him, and had something of he was himself something of a literary man, in addition to being a Judaic scholar. And young Agnon is allowed to read whatever he wants, and he, at a young age, begins to absorb, of course, Yiddish and the budding Hebrew language literature that's growing amongst him, as well as world literature, which he would have encountered either in translation to Yiddish or Hebrew, or in German, which was the only other language that he really had any fluency in. And he begins writing and publishing at a very young age, again, first in Yiddish and then in Hebrew. And by the time he arrives in the land of Israel in 1908, at around the age of 20, he's completely left Yiddish behind as a language of his art, and he dedicates himself completely to being a Hebrew author. He was very fortunate in that he found himself a patron in the person of Shlomo Zalman Shokin, of the famous Shokin Publishing House, which till this day is still Agnon's Hebrew publisher. Shokin was his patron, and that allowed him throughout most of his life to dedicate himself fully to his craft and to not have to worry about supporting himself in some other manner, which so many authors and artists, of course, have to struggle with. And that meant he had a very, very long, active career. He seems to have, although there were certain projects that he wrestled with, he seems to have never struggled from writer's block a day in his life. He wrote and he revised, he would write and stick it away in the drawer and let the ideas percolate and come back to something years later. But he had this extremely prolific career and was writing up until a number of months before his death in 1970. And after he died, he left behind a wealth of material that his daughter, at his instruction, serving as his executor, posthumously published. And for many years after Agnon's death, every few years, a new volume would be published. Both anthologized writings that had appeared in periodical literature but hadn't been produced in book form, as well as original material that had not been published, including whole novels and long story cycles. So it was this very rich and very long and very fruitful career. Of course, as I mentioned in 19... 19-
Hold on. This was in Hebrew.
Yes, in Hebrew.
Have any of those been... Are any of those part of the 15
the
series?
Including the posthumous writings. Our series covers material that was both published in his lifetime as well as some material from the posthumous collection.
I asked you to choose one of Agnon's stories that you find particularly meaningful, and you chose the story called The Prime of Her Life in English. Can you talk about how that's an example of Agnon's genius? And I know it wasn't easy to choose just one.
Yeah. Now that I recall that we had earlier discussed this and I had mentioned it, although, you know, like you ask someone who's your favorite, you ask a parent who's your favorite child, it's hard to pick, and it depends on my mood and what I'm interested in. I must have chosen that story in The Prime of Her Life, which appears in our series in a volume called Two Scholars Who Were in Our Town and Other Novellas, because Agnon wrote in a whole variety of genres. From the very, very, very small, almost microscopic short story to the long, sprawling, multi-hundred page novel. But I find his novellas, his long short stories, to be the most compelling. I find that's his, as a writer, not necessarily as a storyteller, But the art of his writing, where he's engaging almost in a form of rabbinic midrash. You know, your listeners may be aware of the rabbinic mode of midrash, where the rabbis are writing in a way that's in dialogue with the biblical text, and almost continuing that work of the biblical text through all types of intricate plays on theme, plays on symbols, word plays. Agnon's doing that. Part of his achievement was that he took the entirety of Jewish literature that had preceded him, from the Bible through the rabbinic literature, the Mishnah, the Talmud, the Midrash, a medieval Hebrew writing, medieval Hebrew poetry, the Hebrew writing of the Haskalah, of the Jewish Enlightenment, of course, all of the great Yiddish authors that had preceded him, Hasidic tales, the entirety of Jewish literature, and distilled it and poured it into the mold of modern literature. And that particular story that you point to in The Prime of Her Life is a very good example of that, in terms of how he's working through some of these larger themes that run throughout his other works as well. And part of the universe, the literary universe that he paints, that he creates, is the idea that everything is interconnected. So a minor character in this story will appear as in a cameo, a major character in this story will appear in a cameo role in a different novel or in a different story, and kind of creates this idea that all of his stories not only are in dialogue with the world that came before them, but are in dialogue with each other. And in The Prime of Her Life, which is this very touching tale, it happens to be, in some ways it's quite exceptional in Agnon's canon, because it's the only story that's told from the mouth of a female narrator. Although Agnon wrote many wonderful female characters, in many of his stories, actually, the female character, the woman character, is the stronger character. The men often tend to be these passive figures, and the women are sometimes the ones that have the greater pathos and the greater complexity of personality. But this is the only case where the narrator of the tale is herself a woman, and in this case, a young woman who's narrating, who's telling her story. But like Agnon does with his male narrators, and in almost every case, the male narrator of Agnon's stories, we, the reader, are meant to believe is Agnon himself. Now, of course, it was not Agnon himself. It was a game that he played with his readers. And people, even some of the most respectable scholars, make the mistake of saying things like, Agnon says such and such and such and such, when in fact, it's Agnon's narrator, who's a character that he's created, even when that narrator himself is sometimes called Agnon and shares biographical details. But it's a kind of projection of his persona into the story. So in this story, The Prime of Her Life, the narrator, this young woman, Tirza Mintz, is narrating her story. And by the time you get to the end, to a kind of rather surprise ending, as happens with most of his stories, you realize you have to go back, because the narrator was not terribly reliable. And you, the reader, fell for what she was telling you, at least the first time you read it. Agnon apparently once playfully said, any story not worth reading twice probably wasn't worth reading the first time. And when you get to the end and you realize exactly what's happening, how unreliable a narrator she was, you have to go back and read it again with the knowledge you've gained the first time through. And it's a really it's a lovely story. It's a complex story. It's in some ways a heartbreaking story, but it's also a story, like so many of his other pieces, which has a kind of indeterminate ending. The story supports different interpretations, and you know, you'll read it at one point and then you'll come back and read it again a couple of years later. It's a story that I've read many times and I've taught many times. And each time I read it, I come to a different conclusion about what he's saying. And it's not that the story's changed, of course. It's that I've changed, that I'm now more mature than I was the first time I read it. And maybe that means I read it better. Maybe it actually means that I read it less accurately, but it's the kind of thing you can keep going back to, seeing new material in it. So as a kind of introduction to his writing, it's a nice place to start.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thank you. So you've just explained that he was influenced by the entire canon of Jewish writing across the centuries. Were there any authors, contemporary or historical authors, that influenced him? And are there any authors, writers that you would compare to Agnon?
Oh, well, that
is two questions in one.
That is a very tricky conversation. In 1966, when he wins the Nobel Prize, he goes to Stockholm to receive the prize from the king, and he's asked to give a speech. And in the speech, which you can read, you can also listen to it online on the Nobel Prize speech, on the Nobel Prize website, but also you can read it in one of our volumes. He discusses this question of who were his influences, because Agnon was aware that literary scholars, both in Israel and abroad, were comparing him to other authors. And he sometimes bristled at those comparisons. And he makes a very outlandish claim that really his influences were the books you would find in the traditional rabbinic bookshelf, that you would find in the Beit Midrash, in the Jewish study hall, the Bible and the Talmud and the Mishnah and things like that. But of course, he goes on to say, people have ascribed to me influences of authors whose names I haven't even heard. Huh. Agnon was often compared to Kafka. Earlier, you had read a selection from a story which in English is called Lawless. That's a story which bears very, very clear resonances with Kafka. The reader familiar with Kafka's The Trial will understand why these two authors were compared. But Agnon claimed that he'd never really read Kafka. It's not true what sometimes is reported, that he said he'd never heard of Kafka. He had Kafka. If you visit Beit Agnon, you'll see we have Kafka's writings both in Hebrew as well as in the original German. Someone once pointed this out to Agnon, and he said, "Oh, those are my wife's." But he was not fluent in Kafka's writing, and he actually claimed that it was somehow foreign to the root of his soul, whatever that means. But it means that this was not to his taste. And others have pointed out that the fact that there's a similarity between the two, that they both write, particularly in Agnon's more modernistic pieces, his stories that he starts writing in the 30s, these kinds of surrealistic, nightmarish pieces, which really do depict the conflict and the contrast and the transition between the world of tradition and the world of modernity, the world of faith and the world of doubt. These are stories that bear that very distinct Kafkaesque resonance. But the fact that we call that genre Kafkaesque is only because Kafka, you know, kind of put his signature on it. And others, of course, had written in this genre before. And the great Agnon scholar, Professor Arnold Band, pointed out over 50 years ago that both Agnon and Kafka were influenced by earlier writers. They were both influenced by the writings of the Hasidic rabbi Nachman of Breslov, whose writings itself, if it weren't anachronistic, we would say that Rabbi Nachman's writings are Kafkaesque. And that would have lent this influence. Agnon, of course, did admit the influences of other great European writers, of Homer, of Cervantes, of Balzac. Some have pointed to many parallels with Proust. Agnon acknowledged the influence of some of the Scandinavian writers like Ibsen and Hamsun. And that's very clear in some of his writings. There's been, of course, like all great writers of the early and mid-20th century, it's impossible to not see here and there the influences of Freud on Agnon's writings. And Agnon and his family were part of a larger circle of students of Freud who came and established the psychoanalytical school in Jerusalem. So he was familiar with these things, and that also finds their way into his writings. But each of these, you know, I've just listed a catalog of very wide and diverse classics of the Western canon. Each in their own way make appearances. Freud is going to appear in ways that Cervantes doesn't, and vice versa.
So can you talk a little bit about Agnon's sense of humor and how he addressed issues of the day?
Agnon was a great ironist. Irony appears on almost every page. Not just that the narrator himself, this kind of first person narrator who sometimes stands outside of the action and sometimes is taking part in the action, the narrator, this kind of puppet, the sock puppet of the man himself, of the author himself, has a great ironic sense of humor. But Agnon also knew, even in his darkest works, even in his most tragic works, and one could say that tragedy is, in one way or another, not precisely in the Greek sense of the term, but tragedy, the tragedy of the Jewish condition, is a major theme in what he's doing. But even in the bleakest, darkest moments, Agnon knew as a kind of craftsman the importance of injecting humor to release some of the tension in a story where needed. In terms of addressing the issues of the day, although he wasn't principally a satirist, he does have a collection of satires about political life, political satires, collected under the title The Book of State, things that are poking at both the young state of Israel, as well as things that were written about the state in formation prior to the establishment of the state in 1948. And despite his identification as a sincere Zionist, as an artist, he was able to poke and skewer the ridiculousness of public life, particularly of the pompousness of politics and politicians. And that's a very entertaining small collection of these types of satires collected as the Book of State. We have them in our collection. They're all together in a slim volume called The Orange Peel and Other Satires. And those are his humorous political satires. But that being said, unlike so many other authors and artists today, Agnon didn't really speak out on matters of the day and on controversies and things like that. Here and there he would, and at the end of his life he had some things to say after the Six-Day War as a very old man. But generally speaking, and again, it's important to remember that maybe aside from David Ben-Gurion, Agnon was the most famous public figure in the country. He was certainly the most famous man of letters. And people would turn to him and say, "Mr. Agnon, what do you think about this? What do you think about, you know, what was in the newspaper? What do you think about what's going on in the Knesset?" And he would smile and say, "I wrote a story about that." And people would say, which story? And he would say, I forgot. So he also, in addition to the fact that he almost never interpreted his own works, you know, that left people to speculate about what he was really saying and thinking. And he left it all on the page. He wasn't speaking out. He wasn't telling people how to vote or who to support and things of that nature.
How did his writing change when he got to Palestine?
When he arrives in Palestine in 1908, again, as a very young man, he sets himself to really become a great Hebrew author, which then was a rather small market. Hebrew itself was in the early stages of being revived as a modern language. And indeed, part of his achievement is helping to contribute to the revival or the reawakening, as he would have said, the reawakening of the language as it's flowing out of his pen. But at that point, he begins to write stories of the land of Israel. Prior to his arrival in 1908, he had written short pieces. There were no major works that were published before his arrival. And as a matter of fact, later in life, when he starts publishing the different editions of his collected writings, almost none of the material that was written and published before 1908, before his arrival in the land of Israel, were included in his collected writings. He understood that these were the adolescent scribblings of a teenager, and they were not worthy. There were three short stories that get reworked in different ways later in the writing, or there was some material that he'd published in Yiddish where you can see the origins of later stories in their earlier iterations in those stories. So his writing changed in the sense that he himself identifies his arrival with his arrival in Jaffa in 1908 as the true beginning of his career. And from that point, he continues to write on these kinds of parallel tracks where he's simultaneously writing stories of the old world, as well as stories of principally what comes to be known as the Second Aliyah, this wave of immigration in the decade before World War I, this wave of immigration that he was part of when he arrived in 08. And even much later in life, in the 40s and 50s and 60s, he's not writing stories that are set in that time. The stories that he's writing are more or less set, with some exceptions, of course, they're more or less set in the world of Buchach, the world of his youth, at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, or in that decade of the Second Aliyah leading to World War I. There are a certain amount of minority, but a certain amount of stories that are set in Germany, where he spent 12 years during a kind of extended sojourn from 1912 to 1924, at which point he returned to Jerusalem. So those are the main focuses of where he's setting his writing. And the arrival in Jaffa in 1908, with the publication of his first important story, a short story called Agunot, from which he takes the pen name Agnon, which then becomes his, not just his pen name, but his actual name, is a story that's set in that world of Jerusalem in those years. But it's a story that depicts the tension between the old world of Europe and the new world of the land of Israel, which is, of course, a theme that runs throughout all of his writing.
This has been so interesting, and I want to leave you with just a couple more questions that I need to know. First of all, how do you see scholars using the complete set of Agnon's writing? What kind of research would you hope for, or would you suggest? And the second question is, what's next for you? What's your next project?
Look, I hope that the principal use of the Agnon Library will be both for scholars and lay people to encounter Agnon. And, you know, I have a friend who was told me he was reading who was reading Agnon, and I was quite dismayed to discover that he was reading it from my edition, because he's someone that is capable and should be reading Agnon in the original Hebrew. And of course, all translators, no matter how fond you are of your own work, understand that people that are able to read Agnon in the original Hebrew should be doing that. But that said, our volumes have features that are missing from the Hebrew volumes. With only one notable exception, there are no annotated editions of Agnon's work in Hebrew. And as we said, part of his achievement is this intertextual work with the entirety of the rabbinic canon, the Jewish canon that came before him. And our annotations try to flesh those out, both identifying sources as well as trying to give some kind of bridge for the reader to what the meaning of those connections are. And Agnon's use of his intertextual sources is itself a subject, could be a subject of a different conversation. And our annotations help the reader do that, be he or she a reader of the text in the original or the translation. So I think in that regard, it's also particularly useful to scholars in serving as a bridge to some of that classical literature, as well as interpretation of realia and particular things that existed in the time that the contemporary reader is just simply not going to understand, because these are stories, some of them written over 100 years ago, describing a society and a civilization that sadly no longer exists. And the annotations can flesh that out for both the general reader as well as the scholar. In terms of what's next for me, I maybe in the future will come back. We say that this series in 15 volumes is the most complete collection of Agnon's writings in translation, but it is not the entire canon of his writings. There are stories which we have not yet translated. The history of which Agnon stories have been translated, when they were translated, is a fascinating one. Why some, you know, frankly insignificant stories were translated decades ago, and some of his most important works were only now translated with our series. But I still have a wish list of stories that I'd like to see translated. Maybe we'll come back to that. And I wear a whole variety of hats in my professional life, and I have other projects and involvement. As you said, I recently became the editor of the journal Tradition, which seems to be a kind of all-encompassing labor. And that's all on top of my day job, running a program called webyeshiva.org, where actually I broadcast my lectures on Agnon from the Agnon House, and we have people that participate from all over the world. And maybe here we can connect your two questions. I'm always fascinated to meet, you know, people who are interested in reading and studying Agnon. Very many of them, of course, by definition, are people that are themselves Jewish, that have some connection to Jewish literature and Jewish life, one stripe or another. But we find people all the time. There's a scholar from Japan who's visiting Israel now, a Semitic scholar who's a great aficionado of Agnon. He reads Agnon in Hebrew, not in translation. And he came to us at the Agnon House to do some research on what he's doing. And there's another fellow who recently entered our orbit, who's just a great lover of Agnon. He himself is Polish. He's not a Jewish person. He's not a Polish Jew. He's a Pole who lives in China and teaches at some local college. He teaches English. He teaches world literature at a college in China, and he teaches Agnon in translation, in using our English translation. And he writes to me to describe how much his students, how much the world of Buchach, how much the old Jewish traditional world of the towns and villages of Eastern Europe resonate with his contemporary students in China. For a whole variety of reasons. He was describing to me how a description that Agnon has of the tension between the old way of the arranged marriage, the shadchan, versus romantic love, which is a theme that Agnon treats in a variety of places, how they all completely identified with this in their world in China. So I think that our work has a resonance to people, you know, from all over, and can be of benefit to readers in all different types of places.
Well, thank you, Rabbi Sacks. This was such an interesting conversation. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Galit.
And thank you for joining me today. Again, this is G.P. Gottlieb, author of the Whipped and Sipped Mystery Series and host of New Books in Literature for the New Books Network. Today, I've been speaking to Rabbi Jeffrey Sacks, series editor of the S.Y. Agnon Library at the Toby Press. If you enjoyed today's podcast and would like to discuss it further with me and other New Books Network listeners, please join us on Shuffle. Shuffle is an ad-free, invite-only network focused on the creativity community. As NBN listeners, you can get special access to conversations with a dynamic community of writers and literary enthusiasts. Sign up by going to www.shuffle.do/NBN/join.